Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Marcel Proust may have said it best. "I believe," said the great French novelist, "that reading, in its original essence, is that fruitful miracle of a communication in the midst of solitude." Now neuroscientist Marianne Wolfe says yes, but it's more than that. The human brain, she says, is endlessly pliable. A generation of research that began on the humble squid shows that the very act of reading itself actually shapes the human brain, and by that has shaped our history, our culture, our civilization. Now in the digital age, we are reading less. She sees devolution. Up next on Point, reading Proust and the squid. Joining me now in the studio is Marianne Wolfe, neuroscientist and professor of child development at Tufts University. She directs the Center for Reading and Language Research at Tufts. Her new book is Proust and the Squid, The Story and Science of the Reading Brain. Marianne Wolfe, a very warm welcome to you.
And it's a true pleasure to be here with you, Tom.
Also with us today from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine, and no mean reader. Jack, great to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Professor Wolfe.
Hello.
Marianne Wolfe, first to you. There's so much to unpack here, but since it's about reading, let's just start right off having you read just a little bit from the very top, chapter one of your book, Proust and the Squid.
"We were never born to read. Human beings invented reading only a few thousand years ago. And with this invention, we rearranged the very organization of our brain, which in turn expanded the ways we were able to think, which altered the intellectual evolution of our species. Reading is one of the single most remarkable inventions in history. The ability to record history is one of its consequences. Our ancestors' invention could come about only because of the human brain's extraordinary ability to make new connections among its existing structures, a process made possible by the brain's ability to be shaped by experience. This plasticity at the heart of the brain's design forms the basis for much of who we are and who we might become."
Marianne Wolfe, reading from the very top of her new book, Proust and the Squid. All right, you get a lot on the table here, everything from the neuroscience of how reading carves our brains, shapes our brains, to how that then capacity has made possible history and in many ways our culture, our civilization. And you go from there to some pretty sharp concerns about the digital age where we read less or differently and what that may mean for our culture. But take us first to the part that fewer of us may have an understanding of, and that is this plasticity of the brain. Mm-hmm. You make the case that reading, A, doesn't come naturally, and that when we make the sort of wonderful forced march to learn it, we actually change our brains. Neuroscientist Wolfe, how does that work?
Well, I'd like you to think about it as if we are in a moment of cartography. And neuroscientists are like cognitive cartographers mapping the ways a particular function like reading or just the smallest function like naming a single letter crisscrosses the brain. And there's a wonderful Boston neuroscientist who studies vision named Carla Schatz who likened the early development of the visual system to setting down telephone wires across the country. And if you want to think about it this way, reading is like using some of those telephone wires for language, for vision, and connecting them in a whole new way. It's not that reading is changing the structures or the genes. There are no new structures being used, and there are no genes specific only to reading.
But too bad, because we have to learn it again and again.
That's the whole point. That's the wonderful point. It means that each new reader's brain has to learn afresh how to make a circuit a rearrangement of all those existing parts. So it's as if we have a telephone wire system for vision, a telephone wire system for language and for conceptual and for feelings. And reading is this invention that the brain learns how to reconnect all those parts in a new way.
What does that mean? Does the flow of, neurons or does synapses connections actually change when we learn reading? What is the scientifically observable change in the brain?
Okay. One of the wonderful things about the last 20 years is that we can actually watch the brain as it gets activated while it does anything from as small as moving your little pinky finger to reading a passage from Middlemarch. And when we watch, what we see is we see how the eye activates the occipital lobes, the very back part, the posterior parts of our brain. And then that activates, goes, it literally, like I said about a telephone wire, it activates frontal parts and then middle parts. And all of those things become stronger and stronger as the new reader learns and becomes automatic. And automatic, you can think of as if it's a really strong connection. It's absolutely as fast as can be.
But it was the capacity was there, but it's built up. Is it like building up a muscle, or is it the wrong metaphor?
It's the wrong metaphor. Mm-hmm. It's the right metaphor and a wrong metaphor. The muscle already exists, and so
muscles can be bigger or smaller. But
they become more refined with use, and those connections become more refined, stronger, faster with use. But here's the little tricky part that's so wonderful. Once those neurons get connected and become really strong, they become so automatic, it allows it to have almost a whole new territory available for use. And here's what I want you to think about the child. The child spends a year learning to get all those wires connected and fast.
Learn the alphabet, recognize
Learn
words,
the
string
alphabet,
them together, and
decoding,
fly.
Mm-hmm. All of those things. But then that beautiful change, that transition into your brain and mind, that expert reading, is when it becomes so lightning fast, it allows us to activate all other parts of the brain that we use for thinking, that we use for feeling, for imagining, for thinking new thoughts.
Turned on by reading, without reading, not turned on. In that turning on, you see the unleashing of capacity that has enabled all kinds of insight, analysis, empathy, intellectual work, culture
all
building.
Of this, yes.
But are you making the case that would not happen without reading?
It's a beautiful question. And the person who should be here would be Socrates, who would have said,
We tried.
He would have said that oral language allows some of these very same things. But here's where a point that I think Jack Beattie would be very interested in, and that is what reading did was allowed this democratization so that more and more people could have more and more capacity for inference. And where Socrates was really wrong is that written language allows us to go even deeper, more quickly, more efficiently than the oral language mode allowed.
He was suspicious of written language.
He was so suspicious. Very few people understand or ever remember that when they studied Socrates, he actually said, don't read, that literacy will change memory and knowledge and virtue.
Let's bookmark that and come back to it. But I want to get to your bottom line here, which is that, Americans now, a recent survey just last month, one in four adults read no books books in the past year. Of those who do read, hardly ravenous readers. Of those who do read, maybe four books a year. Mm-hmm. Digital realm coming in with all kinds of images and not exactly book reading, a different style. Mm-hmm. Are you prepared to make the case that as we migrate onto the internet in a kind of digital interaction, we're going to lose that capacity and with it lose civilization?
No.
Okay,
what's
your argument?
That would be too strong. But there is a room in this world, this moment, for absolute caution about what we should preserve and what we might lose. Now, what I know best is what is precious about what we have attained. What I know least is how the changes of the digital world are literally going to change the activation patterns. My concern, my worry, is that we will not form a brain that is so accustomed to automatic inference, to automatic critical thinking, before the immersion in the digital world. It's not that the digital world...
individually, one by one, as we grow up.
That's right. It's a true developmental, not a binary either-or, either you're a serious reader.
But that capacity for inference is at the heart of our culture.
That's exactly right. And it's at the heart of the formation of the reading brain as we have it today. So my perspective is that we need not believe that we have to choose, but rather we have to choose deliberately to keep and form that reading brain that then can take all its inferential skills as it reads books on the screen.
Jack, I'd love to get your thoughts on what Marianne's begun to unfold here. Our brains carved, the capacity actually carved by reading, and what may be at risk if we read less.
Well, one of the things that might be at risk is freedom. Professor Wolf adverted to this, but the connection between the Gutenberg Revolution and the democratic revolutions of the 18th century could not be clearer. Before the book, before Gutenberg, the church ruled through miracle, mystery, and authority. You took it from them. With the book, people could begin to challenge authority through their own brain. And no one put this revolution clearer than Thomas Jefferson in a letter written 10 days before his death to John Adams. He hoped, he said, that the Declaration of Independence would burst the chains under which the monkish ignorance and superstition had persuaded men to bind themselves and to assume the blessings and security of self-government. That form, which we have substituted, restores the free right to the unbounded exercise of freedom, of reason and freedom of opinion. The general spread of the light of science has already laid open to every view the palpable truth that the mass of mankind has not been born with saddles on their backs, nor a favored few booted and spurred, ready to ride them legitimately by the grace of God. What a statement about self-rule. The divine right of kings was a fiction, a myth put forward through ignorance, and what ended it was precisely the interiority, the self-consciousness, and the critical thinking of reading.
Thomas Jefferson, as if I recall correctly, his own library had 6,500 books. He once said, "I cannot live without books." Mm-hmm. Marianne Wolf, that puts major stakes on the table, and that's just a kind of the political piece of it. You write that there's a creative quality at the heart of reading. And interestingly, you say we cannot take for granted that we will continue to... to have that. You say nothing in our intellectual development should be less taken for granted at this moment in history as the transition to a digital culture accelerates its pace. What do you see at risk there in our capacity?
Okay. I want to say two different things. The first is that when I was talking about all that gets connected when we read, I'm also talking about the knowledge, the memory of what we have read before as being connected to whatever we see in front of us.
Individually.
So I want to thank you, Jack, for that incredible passage. I've always wanted to talk to you, Jack, so it's such a pleasure to do it in this format. But Joseph Epstein said it better than I will. He said, "We are what we read." If you examine the biography of any person, you can see they are so much the stuff of what they've read. And one of my fears is that the stuff of what our children reading is not the same kind of information, the same kind of experience that we have taken for granted as part of our formation as readers in a society. And the second point is
Let's hold that one first. Why? Yes. What's the difference? We are what we read. Maybe we are what we surf. We are what we YouTube. Mm-hmm. We are what we click and pursue and follow through the mm-hmm. vast network of the Internet. What is essentially okay. different?
Now, think of this, Tom. Your brain has been trained to be a critical mind. It brings to bear everything that you know, everything you've read. You're set to infer, you're set to analyze, you're set to probe.
Because I read so much? Or do I surrender that when I click online?
No, because you were formed in that way. You have a formation. Remember when we were talking about how those wires were set down? Mm-hmm. Part of it, part of your formation and mine and Jack's and Jefferson's mm-hmm. and Epstein's was to probe. Think deeply. If you will, it's a deep form of reading. And just because it's coming immediately to my mind, I'm thinking of what Noam Chomsky once said about mm-hmm. a deep structure to language mm-hmm. and a surface structure. I'm not going to use it in the same way here, but I think like Socrates' worry that our children could become fantastic decoders of information, but they will not have formed that set to think and to go deeper into what they read, in part because of the way the presentation itself exists.
Online presentation page after page of the well of a book.
There's a voluminousness, there's an immediacy in the print that speeds you on. And my worry, and it is a caution, not knowledge. This is where mm-hmm. my knowledge is, mm-hmm. as a neuroscientist mm-hmm. stops mm-hmm. and my caution begins. Mm-hmm. My worry is that the children and youth will be deluded into thinking their Googled universes make them know it all when they've just decoded, not gone below the surface.
We're going to go to a digital scholar to test that concern, that fear, but let's go to our listeners first. Dan is calling from Middletown, Connecticut. Dan, you're on the air.
Thanks. Hi, Tom. I wanted to just say I work with kids, and I've noticed something about readers versus non-readers is that the kids who read tend to be able to empathize and are much more creative because their experience isn't limited by what they actually mm-hmm. have seen and heard, mm-hmm. smelled and touched. They have this whole world of the books they read, and they can put themselves in that place and draw from those experiences and tend to have a much deeper mm-hmm. understanding of how the world works and how things relate. Because they have to be creative and not just rational, but also mm-hmm. emotional connections with the characters and mm-hmm. the activities in the book.
Dan, if I may interject, Marianne writes, through our ability to study people's thought processes across 3,000 years of the written word, we are able to internalize the consciousness of human beings we could never otherwise imagine. Does that go away, though, necessarily, Dan, when we're clicking and surfing?
I think it gives us a much deeper background when we're clicking and surfing. I mean, I like YouTube as much as the next person, but I think that without the amount of books that I've read, and I read probably two a week, I wouldn't have an understanding of, you know, some of the videos and the cartoons and, you know, some of the literary references that are out there that would just be lost if I was looking at it as a pretty picture and a, you know, just an image on a screen.
Dan, thanks for that report. Let's get another Dan from Temple, New Hampshire. New Hampshire, Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. This is a wonderful, interesting topic, and it's inspiring. I'm a teacher. I teach tracking and primitive skills to kids.
What does that mean, tracking and primitive skills, Dan?
Primitive skills would be nature awareness, survival, shelter building, and tracking, of course, would most often pertain to animal tracking,
okay.
although I won't leave out some of the bigger pictures of geology. But quickly, modern reading, I have a hunch, and I'm working on a study of this, modern reading as an evolution out of the most ancient form of literature, tracking, and also that I believe that this tracking I've imagined that has certainly had an effect on our brains as we've evolved.
Dan, we don't track animals so much anymore, in great numbers of us anyway. Do you fear that we lose something if we read less as well?
Yes, absolutely. We both lose something, and I believe also Socrates was right, that we lost something when we lost the oral tradition, but we've gained something else, and something similar may be happening now.
Dan, that's great. Thank you very much for that. All right. Marianne, lots of interesting stuff here. I mean, one thing, Socrates was worried when we went from the oral tradition to the written tradition. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot discussed over the years about how many humans used to memorize vast amounts of poetry, let's say, or sagas. We don't do that so much anymore. And yet, we've evolved through each of these things, you know. Mm-hmm. What does the evolution of literacy tell us about, you know, how survivable a little less reading might be, or how we've come to this point and what it's meant that literacy has evolved as it has?
Well, I think we are actually in a very large transition, and Jack, I believe, alluded to it too. We had the transition from oral language to written language, and now we're in the midst of a transition from really a literacy epoch to a digital one. And I think we have lessons about the formation of knowledge. It is not coincidental that 2,000 plus years ago, I'm still looking back to the question Socrates raised. He wasn't opposed to literacy as literacy. He was opposed to thinking that we would become decoders, only decoders, and not really after a form of knowledge that was so internalized that we could use it wherever we are. Now, he was right and wrong about memory, text, digital, what all of these different modes of presentation preserve in ways that oral language could never attempt to do. But he was correct about the internalization of knowledge. And I am worried about the internalization of knowledge in a digital world when we have no need for it. And that's something that's, I think, a very important issue here. I do want to actually say two things to each Dan, though, if you will. The first Dan, I want to say that one of the more inspiring aspects of learning for me about early reading development is how essential children's understanding of characters and books, how essential that is for their ability to empathize, to take on perspectives of others. You have George and Martha, these loving hippos. You have Frog and Toad. Frog is sick. Toad comes over. And you see this essential empathy that's being fostered and reinforced by books. It's a wonderful thing. But the strangest thing I have to say is to New Hampshire, Dan. Mm-hmm. And that is our ability to see tracks, Dan, is really one of the skills that is part of our repertoire in our brain of recognizing patterns. And when the brain reads, it actually uses some of the same areas our ancestors used to recognize the pattern of tracks.
You quote Menander, 4th century BCE. Is that an Egyptian king or something? I don't know. But he says, those who can read see twice as well. Marianne, Jack, if you stand by for just a moment, I want to bring another perspective into this conversation. Joining us, and I'm delighted to have her, from Madison, Wisconsin, is Constance Steinkuhler. She is professor of educational communication and technology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. She studies how digital media are changing the way we think, learn, and interact. Professor Steinkuhler, thanks very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So you've heard Marianne Wolfe lay out her thesis, her close focus on the plasticity of the brain and how reading shapes it through the act of reading, and her fears about where we're headed as we move into the digital age. Do you share those fears, or do you see us simply adding capacity?
Well, it's a wonderful conversation so far. I'm delighted to be able to participate in it. To back up a bit, the groups that I study tend to be the kids who are disaffiliated in school.
What does that mean?
Parents, meaning that they fall into two types of categories. They either don't do well in school and are barely making it or failing, or for a variety of reasons that could be the work that they're doing, it could be that they won't do the work. And then the other group are actually doing well in school but see schooling as nothing more than credentialing, which is, in my mind, as a person in education, just as frightening.
So they both have a kind of arm's length relationship with school. What about reading versus digital engagement?
Right. So I study kids who are doing really what I consider high-end practices online, things like online worlds and participating in game cultures, etc. And one thing that you find in literacy practices that deal with the internet in particular is that you see a marvelous shift from what I would call consumption to production, meaning that, you know, earlier there was discussion about YouTube and about some of the content of what is online and about how the Gutenberg Revolution was really a democratic revolution. And I couldn't agree more. But one thing to think about, if this is a change toward from paper, print, literacy over to a digital literacy, what you're seeing is a similar democratic revolution. Rather than, for example, Levi's sending me an ad that I'm supposed to consume, and if I'm lucky, I might be able to consume it critically and decode what it's trying to say and do and manipulate. Rather than that, what you have is tools that now let me produce things.
Yeah, but let me ask you about that. Let's say, I go on YouTube, and I'm not just reading Proust, but I'm making a video of throwing Mentos in a Coke bottle and the explosion that occurs.
Exactly.
Well, okay, but I mean, I'm producing something, but am I producing depth? Does it matter, or am I just kind of, moronically playing with Mentos?
Well, now we have two content questions, don't we? We have one about whether or not I'm reading, and we have another about what I'm reading. And I think it's important to keep those separate. There's a claim that's quite pervasive that kids aren't reading, and I can demonstrate empirically that they are reading, and they're reading copious amounts of text as part of activities like YouTube.
Online, you mean?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, online and offline. Many people like to print it off, so they actually are reading it offline off a screen. But regardless, let's just take video games because they're such a great example because we all have kind of vexed opinions about them. But with games, I mean, the games that I looked at so far really are a constellation of literacy practices.
Constance, I really and truly am open, even prayerful, that going digital means just more capacity and more evolution, but I want to understand it. You say you see literacy emerging from interaction with the kind of, bits and pieces of text online? Is it the same thing as diving into a book of maybe hundreds of pages?
Great question. It depends on first how you define literacy, but if we avoid that kind of sticky question, one of the big patterns that I've seen in our work is that, reading is still there, books are still there, they haven't been displaced, but it has. Digital media have changed the way that activities are organized. So let me give you an example. So what I mean to say here is that the role of books and reading has shifted. The same way that when television came out, it shifted the role of radio. When radio came out, it shifted what was before. So here's a quick example. Another colleague of mine, his name is Kurt Squire, and he does work with a history game. It's a simulation, and it's called Civilization 3. It's very popular.
Sure.
Right. So he does work with this with kids that are considered in many cases at risk, much like the kids I look at.
This is a game where the player sends armies marching around continents and they encounter all kinds of kind of historically minded challenges.
Right. Right. So it's a fabulous game that you play on a map. You can play it on a real world map and you run a civilization through ages and ages. You develop its technologies, you go to war, or you don't go to war, depending on what you decide.
So can I skip Sun Tzu and Machiavelli and just play Civilization and get it?
Yeah. So he's using this game as a way to get students re-engaged in history and treating history like a question and not a set of rote facts. Well, what was so interesting about this was that by the end of some of their first few weeks of practice, of playing the game, you end up finding that the kids start using the history textbook as a cheat to the game.
Now, that's so they can understand the context for the screen game.
Yeah. So what they're doing is, in order to understand why, for example, the Middle East might be a space for conflict, given resource allocations and the way things are distributed across land masses, they started using their history books and going to the library as a way to find information to beat the game.
Let me just ask you, though, what if, and I know you're asserting this is not happening, but what if the reading of books becomes less over time as the digital age kind of expands its presence. And they're not referencing back to history books, but they're sort of plunging deeper and deeper down the digital path. Do you have concerns about that, or do we somehow keep all of reading's capacity and add capacity in addition, even if we're no longer reading as many books?
Oh, I have no fear that reading will ever be replaced. Now, whether it's on paper, on a screen, on a touchpad, I really, frankly, myself, don't care too much.
Well, let's make a distinction between just reading, like a street sign that says stop, or
right.
reading, you know,
right.
Middlemarch.
Uh-huh.
Will we let go of that kind of reading, the long form, book length, and does that matter to your digitally oriented mind?
Oh, you mean reading of a large, like, let's say, Proust versus... the children's book.
Proust or, I don't care, Harry Potter, you name it.
Mm. I don't know. I don't know that we have information on that yet. I'm not sure that we really have had enough time to find out what sort of patterns of consumption are going to emerge over time when it comes to longer versus shorter texts. I will say, to go back to something Marianne was pointing to earlier, mm-hmm. I think that some of the more important research we need to be doing now about reading online is really about shifts of attention.
Mm-hmm.
So what you find with a lot of youth culture is multitasking. A lot of
mm-hmm.
people talk about
yeah.
it. And so it's really an empirical question about what's happening cognitively
mm-hmm.
when someone is in fact engaged in four communication channels, one of which is, say, a text, another of which is, say, a game, and another may be conversation with peers.
Let me bring our listeners in here. Adam is calling from Northampton, Massachusetts. Adam, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a librarian in Northampton, Massachusetts, and one of the things that I do is I deliver books to patrons that can't come to the library, and a lot of the patrons that I deliver books to are in long-term care facilities,
so they're
nursing homes.
Maybe they're older, okay.
Yeah, and one of the things I have noticed is that the people that I deliver books to, and especially the people that read a lot of books, tend to be more lucid and kind of together. And I've been doing this for a number of years, so I've had opportunity to watch people age, not only the patients delivering books to, but to the other patrons around them.
But are they lucid because they read, or they read because they're still lucid?
This is a question. Of course, I mean, I'm not saying that there's quality here, but there is something that, this is something that I've noticed. And I'm wondering if, sort of at the neurological level, that these patrons have sort of created a better neurological fortress to ward off the effects of aging.
Adam, that is a fascinating question, and I've got a related question from another caller. Let me turn to it, and we'll pick them both up. From Nashville, Annie is calling. Annie, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. I am a postmenopausal woman. I was a voracious reader, was never happy unless I had a book.
Okay.
And but over the last 5 or 6 years, as I got older, I found myself less and less able to concentrate on reading long form. And to the point now where I barely read books at all. I mean, I can read a magazine and stuff like that. And
do you miss it? Has it changed your life? Do you miss it, Annie?
Yeah, I do. I miss it terribly, but I still can't get myself to sit down for longer than a few pages in a book. And I was curious, like your other caller, has any work been done on what happens when you can't read? Does those paths unwind? And does it help bring on the aging process more? Or, you know, have they already been stamped in your brain so, you know, you don't have to worry about it?
Oh, it's a great question. And our maybe reading created empathy makes us feel the weight of concern behind it. Annie, we hope it comes back to you. Marianne, let's pick these up. Capacity. Uh-huh. Is there a use it or lose it relationship here? What about when people can't read? You write in the book about dyslexia and the prism that it opens up on our reading. And to Dan's Question, you know, from Northampton, he sees lucidity in readers. Is there a causal connection there? How do you see this bundle of questions?
There are so many wonderful questions, and not to forget Constance, who raised so many beautiful issues about concentration and attention. Mm. And I'll come back to you, Constance. I'm so fascinated by you, your work, and James G's work on video games. But I want to just say one thing about our aging process, and that is that so much of our work with Alzheimer's patients, people with pre-senile dementia, we know that the more we work with language, whether it's crossword puzzles or reading, we are activating that brain. And so I think it's a situation where I like to think that there's always some aspect of plasticity that lasts the entirety of our life, even when in a situation as desperate as Alzheimer's, we're losing aspects. We still have some capacity to activate and let us do what we can.
To Annie's question, does the capacity or do the paths to reading unwind, the neural paths you describe as having been built and strengthened?
Do you know, I do not know the answer to that question with regard to postmenopausal. I do know, just as a matter of empathy with every woman who goes through various cycles, the memory loss that happens certainly during that period does change postmenopausal. So I would look at it as a developmental story for you yourself, Annie.
So there's Annie, there's Dan, there's the library.
But let's come back to Constance.
Yeah, sure.
Because what we're doing is acting out what she was talking about. Well, and this continuous partial attention, what you and I have just gone through, is we're putting our mind across so many topics. And yet what we really want to do is have closure on one after another. And one of my worries, Constance, and I'm very much with you in the use of digital media to engage our disenfranchised, and we use it in our own intervention program, RAVEL, with dyslexic children. We see it as a powerful tool. But my real question is not whether it's important and good and, in fact, ineluctable in our future, but as we move to become more and more digital, what must we preserve about that critical capacity that happens in the formation of our children and our readers?
In the long form.
In the long formation term. That's my goal. I'm as bad or good as Socrates' worry. How we form knowledge in the pursuit of virtue, Jack Beatty.
Let's get testimony from the front line here of the generational change. Layla's calling from East Hampstead, New Hampshire. My screen tells me, Layla, you're 16 years old. What do you think?
Hi, Tom and Marianne. I actually think I concur with what Marianne says, that reading is actually something that is to be valued with this generation, and I do think that it's being lost when we're on the website. And I think that reading a book versus reading online is a lot nicer because you get to actually turn the page and swallow the words instead of just scrolling down the screen.
What's the difference between flipping a page over, Layla, with your fingers and scrolling down with your mouse?
Well, it's just that you're more into it. You're, as Marianne says, you're fingerprinting the book. You're actually, like, touching the book. And you have more contact with the words.
Do you find the mental experience different of being, you know, reading and working online versus digging into a book?
Yeah, actually, I think that whenever I get into a book, I find myself, like, I can't get out of it. But if I'm reading a book online, it's just so much easier to just turn off the computer and leave it, as opposed to looking at the book, which is right next to you.
Well, that's great. Let me get one more call here, Layla. Thank you for that. Let's go to Mita in Boston. Mita, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have two quick questions. I obviously agree with everything that has been said. Reading is a wonderful capacity, and that reading leads to empathy, sympathy, knowledge, etc. But reading could equally lead to other things. Bigotry, for example. We get those kinds of knowledges from books, too. So
yes,
we're not talking only literally of reading, but of other capacities, that is to say, the critical capacity, what we are surrounded by.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing I want to say very quickly is the divide that concerns me is not so much the division between books and the digital media, but that there are almost as many non-readers in the world as there are readers in the world. So So what are we saying about that? Those people somehow who don't read books, cannot read books, are less human than us, cognitively.
There's a troubling
undertone here, and I would like to hear some more from you.
Mita, that's great. Jack Beatty, let me bring it to you. Do you cast the non-readers out from your kingdom of democracy?
Oh, no, not at all. And that's a very, very good point indeed. One of the great proponents of democracy, Rousseau, had a great moment when he on the road to from Geneva, where he ripped up a book. He just threw it away. And he said, I can discover the world for myself. But that very idea of discovering the world for himself came out of the Protestant Reformation, came out of the antecedent generational experience of the book. And yes, books can weigh people down, and looking at life, going at it, you know, freehold, can be authentic, and people can be equal in that way. So I don't say that reading is necessarily essential to democracy. I'm just saying historically that's the way it has been.
When we feel the wine dark sea, Constance, do you see a political change in the digital translation? It sounds as though you see it as supportive of democracy, the participatory part of it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, first I want to really thank the caller, because I think that it's easy to fall into what others have called the literacy myth, where literacy comes to stand for almost Western progress. And we tend to believe that it does a whole lot of work that in empirical reality, it's not as tightly associated as we think. So I want us to be very cautious of that, because you can end up in a place where you do end up arguing that, for example, literate culture is somehow better and more inherently good and virtuous than illiterate culture, or culture that simply has nothing to do with the written word. And I think that's not the intention here at all of the discussion.
Well, I'm not sure. I think that is kind of the argument that's been made. Our time goes down. Marianne, are you going to stand up for literate culture, the read and preserved read culture, is better than the illiterate?
I will say very quickly that I very much appreciated the caller. I began almost with Socrates, who very rarely read a word. He was the proponent of an oral culture and all the beauty that can be in it. The question isn't about oral versus literate. The question is about knowledge. And to what extent is the formation of knowledge, critical thought, and virtue available to more and more people in a society in whatever format? That's really the ultimate goal of anyone who's really talking, whether about the reading brain or the digital brain, or the formation of a digital brain that began with what I consider the highest values of that reading brain.
Our time has flown. You put Marcel Proust right in your title. What does Proust tell us here?
Proust told us that the heart of reading is the generative principle, that we who read go or can go beyond the author's wisdom into forming our own.
Oh, we'll take that and try and ride with it. What a fascinating hour. I want to thank everyone for being with us. Constance Steinkuhler, we'll have to have you back and hear more, but thank you very much for being with us from Madison, Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin today. Thank you very much for joining
us. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Constance.
Jack, it's always great to have you. Thanks very much for being here today.
Thank you.
And Marianne Wolfe, author of Proust and the Squid, The Story and Science of the Reading Brain. Wonderful to have you. Thanks for coming in. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.